Everybody ready for a great day? It's going to be great.
Lisa.
Is that good?
Okay. Lisa.
Yeah, I'm ready.
2, 1. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Richie T. Have you developed some bad habits during the pandemic? Well, coming up, we're going to help you shift back into a healthier lifestyle. And for your morning buzz, Swifties Unite, you have a gift for you waiting in your inbox. We'll talk about that coming up in your morning buzz.
When in the midst of a personal trial, it can be hard to open up to others and even talk about it. We fear they might reject us when they know the full truth. Or maybe we even worry that if we divulge our struggles, we'll be seen as needy or emotional. But the truth is, everyone you know is going through something. And who knows, you being vulnerable to someone else could make it easier for them to do the same thing back. Well, today we're talking with Victoria Anderson, a life coach, about how her personal journey with Crohn's disease helped her be more honest with others. Welcome, Victoria. Thank you for your time.
Hi, thank you for having me, Lisa. I appreciate giving me this time to have a chat with you and share my story.
Yeah, you bet. First of all, for those who aren't familiar, could you explain a little bit about what Crohn's disease is?
Sure. It's an inflammatory bowel disease, and it is an autoimmune disease, and it affects the digestive system from the mouth all the way through. And it causes inflammation. So the lining of the intestine becomes very inflamed and it becomes sort of slick so that it doesn't you don't absorb nutrients. And then in amongst that, there's some really uncomfortable symptoms such as you get ulcers. Like I had ulcers in my mouth and all the way through. There are also, gut pain, you can have joint swelling and a number of other things that go along with it.
So take us back in time a little bit to when you first found out that you had Crohn's disease. As it was, mm-hmm. that knowledge was sort of settling in, what was going through your mind?
I was very much in denial, but not in a negative way. I had never been sick in my entire life. I mean, it was really hard for me to actually get sick. My parents tried to get me to get chicken pox when I was a kid. And unfortunately, and then this woman told me, oh, you know, you're very sick and you're going to be very sick for a long time. And this is, and when I realized it was sort of a chronic thing, I was overwhelmed, like, oh, wait a minute. And so I thought, no, you know what? This isn't who I am. This is not. This is not, I'm not a sick person. This does not compute. So I knew in my heart that it was something that I was doing or not doing in my life. I knew that this was something I was creating somehow.
Knowing or hearing you say that, you know, that you don't identify as this, you know, I am not an unwell person. And then to be able to receive a diagnosis of, you know, that you have Crohn's disease, I think that then people would say, oh, well, that's Victoria, the Crohn's disease person. We identify ourselves weirdly this way, and it makes it harder for us then to be able to share because we don't want to be identified as that one struggle, you know. Oh, that's the divorced this person. That's the
or whatever
struggling
label
with health.
It is.
Yeah, whatever
sure.
that label is. How are you able then to sort of knock down those labels, or have you been able to?
Yeah, in fact, it was interesting. I had so many people come to me and go, oh, you know, there's a support group for Crohn's, and I don't want to say don't ever join things like that, because I do think that it does help to talk to people who are going through similar experiences. But I kind of shied away from those things, mainly because I didn't want to be identified as that. And I ought to be the person who, oh, that's Victoria with Crohn's disease. Yeah, that's too bad. I didn't want to be labeled as that. So I didn't necessarily hide it from people, but I didn't lead with it. Like, hi, I'm Victoria, I have Crohn's disease.
Right.
It was just one of those things that just, oh, and by the way.
So you say then telling the truth has really helped you through Crohn's disease. And I'm wondering what that really means.
Yeah. So when I look back at what was going on in my life at the time, and it was really hard for me in the moment to go, okay, I knew something, like I just said, I was, you know, I knew something, I was doing something. So, you know, and I thought maybe it was on a physical level. Maybe I'm not eating the right thing. Maybe I'm not meditating enough. Maybe I should take up yoga. So, and I did all those things, and I tried lots of, you know, different diets, and I tried herbs, and I tried different healing modalities, and all those things really helped. But I was really wanting to get to the root of what was going on. And when I started working with a coach, that's when I realized I could see the pattern. And the pattern for me was I was not presenting myself into the world. I was presenting as someone else. So I was trying to be the perfect mom, the perfect wife, the, you know, trying to look perfect, trying to have a very, you know, on the outside, and on the out, and I did a good job of that. You know, I'm from the outside, it looked pretty good. Like it looked, you know, nice house, nice car, nice family, nice husband, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, going to church every Sunday and doing all the right things and volunteering but on the inside, I wasn't being me. I wasn't expressing myself as me, and I wasn't happy. And so that's when I realized, oh, that's the pattern. So who do I need to be? How do I need to show up in the world? And I wasn't sharing my gifts with the world.
We're talking with Victoria Anderson and having a conversation about being honest, being authentic, and we've sort of surrounded that in the story of you coming to grips with a diagnosis of Crohn's disease. But I think the lesson greater for those that might not find themselves in that same physical ailment is this idea of living authentically, being honest about how they are. Something that I have found fascinating, particularly in this subject recently, is the idea of honest, like we want to be a trustworthy and honest person. And mm-hmm. I think that's where we most often go. But the other side of that honest is that you can't really ever feel truly loved or accepted if you're being dishonest, because you have that question of, well, if people really knew
right.
who and how I was,
that's the fear, right?
Would they like me? How do we get past that fear? Because I can guarantee that on some level, each and every one of us, we need to be loved, we need to be accepted, and knowing that we put our full vulnerable selves out there and don't know what we're going to get, that's scary.
Oh, yeah. It's a biological fear, right? When you think about, you know, when we lived in tribes, and if you were not accepted by the tribe, you could maybe not survive. So I think also knowing that, here's what I also realized is that here I was putting on this facade, but underneath it all, people knew. You know, people, we actually know, we're pretty instinctual species, right? We kind of know, like, something's a little off, you know? So it might look good, but something's a little off. And so I think our gut feeling, I think we know that. And so when I started to tell people the truth and tell them, you know, this is actually who I really am. I'm really not like this. People kind of went, oh, I kind of knew that.
Huh.
They weren't surprised. There were, and I literally, you know, one of the exercises I did with my coach was I had to literally go around to people I lied to and tell them the truth. And when I did that, not one person went, oh my goodness, I had no idea. People said, oh, you know, I kind of knew that. And even my 8-year-old, who was 8 at the time, she's not 8 now, but at the time she was 8, she said, oh, I knew that. What? She knew. So I think we think we're fooling people, but we actually aren't. And then in my experience, it's invited, I've made new friends, I've brought in new people into my life. And not that I've, you know, shunned everyone else, but it just opens you up to even more people. I find I'm more open.
Hmm. Well, for those who aren't ready to maybe like completely be open with others about the things that they're struggling with, is there a lesson to be learned in how they can start opening up in smaller ways? Is it still as beneficial?
Yeah, so I'm not a totally open book. I don't walk around telling everyone all my business and what's going on in my family and all those kinds of things. Uh-huh. I don't believe in that either. I think there's a time and a place and the right person and to share those things with. But I just don't want to be lying or presenting myself as someone other than who I am. So while you don't have to hang everything out for everyone to see, you also can just be yourself in amongst that. And I think that it's a little bit of a play. Like, I've played around with that over the years since I've realized this pattern about myself. So I don't want to be completely out there telling everyone every little nitty gritty detail of my life. But I also don't want to be telling people, oh, I'm really happy about something when I'm not, mm-hmm. as well.
We paint the picture of a happy ending. Let me go down this rabbit hole a little bit, where we think, and we've had this discussion a bunch, and I guess maybe I'm in the mood to sort of push back against it, that we would openly share who we are and we're honest, and then people sort of accept us for who we are. But there is and can be the, you know, we put ourselves out there how we are and people don't like it.
So there's a risk, you mean?
And people reject it, and those people then become not our friends or, you know, disassociate themselves from us. When we are engaged in that sort of thing, what do you recommend, or what's the next step then?
Yeah, I mean, that can be a really painful situation. I was pretty fortunate that there were definitely people who fell away. They didn't shun me completely, but I had one friend who did. She just completely, like, once she saw the path I was going down, she was like, she couldn't deal with it. She, like, just didn't want to know. And so, but that was painful and it hurt. But now when I look back, I think it was probably for the right reason. You know, for whatever reason, she wasn't on board with it. She wasn't happy with that. She liked me being my fake self. So is that really a friend, right? Is that someone who, and then for me, to continue to evolve and grow as a person, is that the right kind of person that I need next to me to do that?
So as you're a life coach and you sort of navigate these kind of avenues, are these the kind of conversations you have with clients?
Yeah, we do. We have, and often this can also translate into the workspace or into a partnership, you know, whether it's a marriage or a relationship, even families, you know, sometimes families don't quite understand. But it's learning how to talk about it and meet people where they are and take care of other people. When you're explaining these things, you know, you don't want to just come at people with stuff. So even when I was going around having these conversations with people, telling them, well, you know, I had to go to my parents and go, you know, that time I told you I was at the church event, I was actually up in LA going to some concert. Yes, you know, so I was telling these things. But, you know, you set it up in a way. We have a way of working with clients to set up what's called a difficult conversation, and there are steps to having those conversations where you set it up properly. You ask them permission. You always get permission to have these conversations. And then you tell them, if you're nervous about it, you tell them that. You say, hey, you know, I'm really nervous about telling you about this. And then you leave it, you know, then you tell them what you need to tell them, like, you know, in that case with my parents. And then you leave it and you ask them, are there any questions? Do you need anything from me? And then you make promises at the end of that to, hey, you know what? From now on, I'm going to tell you where I am. I'm not going to lie to you about where I am.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think we put off so many difficult conversations, and certainly ones that seem so vulnerable for us, you know, questions about our health or things that we don't want to be defined at, but we know that are going to become a big part of our lives. And yet it seems that when we do, there's not just a relief in that, but there's also an opportunity for a deeper and better connection with the other person, which is ultimately what we're all craving, you know, wouldn't you say?
And Oh, yeah.
And so I'm wondering what life is like for you now, now that you feel like you are more transparent and honest, not only with the Crohn's disease and how you're really doing and really feeling, but with other aspects of your life. What does your life feel like now?
Well, it's interesting because I went to a coach to work on my health. I said, I want to fix this. And but it ended up also improving my marriage because my marriage wasn't great at the time either. And so now I have a much, much richer, deeper connection with my husband, and same with my children. You know, I was trying to be, like I said, the perfect mom, trying to do all the right things. And now now they're older. I have a 20-year-old and a 17-year-old, and I'm able to have pretty open conversations with them, you know, where I talk about my own experiences at their age. Especially with, through the pandemic, you know, trying to really put myself in their position and say, you know what, if I was your age and I was stuck at home with my family, I probably would have been a little angry.
Yeah, just that honesty.
You know, well, versus, oh, well, I would have done something, you know, I would have done something else. I would have read a book or something, you know? So. Yeah, right.
Finding those kinds of connections and being honest, it's a good conversation and one that we can take back into our own homes and have with our loved ones as well. We really thank you for your transparency, Victoria.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me to share that.
You bet, Victoria.
I love sharing that with the world.
Well, Victoria Anderson is an executive life coach at the Handel Group, and you can learn more by going to hglifecoach.com.
Having the opportunity to talk to Victoria and other great folks here on the show is because of emails that we get to thelisashow@byu.edu. A reminder that that email address always open, meaning, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night, you go down to the fridge, you get yourself something to eat, and you go, you know, I've been meaning to email The Lisa Show. Take that opportunity. That's perfectly fine. Maybe you stop at the gas station, you're filling up gas, and you're thinking, you know, I really should email thelisashow@byu.edu. Now, there's some discrepancy as to whether or not you should be using your cell phone next to the gas tank, so let me encourage you to walk away a little bit, send that email in and come back. But thelisashow@byu.edu. We love getting feedback from you. And also, if you're reading a book, if there's someone that you've heard on a podcast that you think, man, that would be a great guest for The Lisa Show, we'd love to be able to talk to them and hear what you're hearing and be able to share that with other folks. It's thelisashow@byu.edu. Now, coming up, we're going to teach you how to adopt healthier habits now that life is coming back to normal. And maybe I don't even need to tell the Swifties. I think the Swifties know, but likely the rest of the world needs to know the world changed overnight. And you need to hear this. I'll tell you about it coming up in your Morning Buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Coming up, we're going to find out how the pandemic has affected our ability to daydream. But first, we've got your Morning Buzz. It is three things that are trending online right now, things that folks are talking about. And this first one, kind of sad. You might know the name Jack Hanna. He is the zoo director that's famous for making TV talk show appearances with live animals. Oftentimes you'll see Jack Hanna and he'll have an animal and something will go terribly awry because you can't coach those live animals to do exactly what they're supposed to. They're animals, for crying out loud. Jack Hanna has been diagnosed with dementia, his family said yesterday. Doctors think that it is Alzheimer's, the family said in a statement. His condition has progressed much faster in the last few months than any of us could have anticipated. Sadly, he will no longer be able to participate in public life as he is used to. So people have been sharing their favorite Jack Hanna appearances from various talk shows and news hits and all those things. But sad to hear that. Secondly, today is National Empanada Day. You ever had an empanada? You know what an empanada is? It's a turnover pastry made of dough that's wrapped around a wide range of savory or sweet fillings. They can be baked or they can be fried.
They can be served hot or they can be served cold. They can be a main or a side dish. Oftentimes, they are stuffed with chicken, beef, or steak, pork loin, ham, fish, and shrimp. Other people will stuff them with things like garlic, onion, tomatoes, mushrooms, corn, chili peppers, potatoes, and my favorite, cheese. Sometimes you'll get a fruit empanada, especially when it's being served as dessert. The word empanada comes from the verb embreaded. So let me tell you, can you celebrate something with bread or meat and cheese and delicious dessertedness? In fact, you could. I don't want to get too crazy here, but you could technically have an appetizer empanada, a main dish empanada today, and a dessert dish empanada. I dare you. National Empanada Day. And then finally this. I was surprised to see this. I'll let you know. I apparently have fallen off my Swift, that is Taylor Swift, game. Brand new song from Taylor Swift. I'm not sure she's still writing about her relationships, but the title of this song is Mr. Perfectly Fine. And it sounds very Taylor Swifty. So if you like the Taylor Swift and what she puts out, a brand new song overnight that now has in the millions and millions and millions and millions and so on of views and or listens. It's called Mr. Perfectly Fine, and it is by Taylor Swift. And that is your morning buzz. Now, we've been thinking about, you know, we're coming out of this global pandemic, and we want to be able to establish good habits, be able to, if there's anything that the time in the pandemic has taught us, is that maybe we don't have the habits that we would like to have, or we've noticed that we've allowed ourselves to fall into some of those things that, well, maybe we perhaps should not have. So when we're looking about maintaining healthy habits, first of all, I think we need to know what it is that they are, but then how we can be able to actually keep and maintain those habits is the topic that we'd like to talk about. And so we'd like to invite into this conversation Alka Sharma. Are you there, Alka?
Hi there. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I want to make sure that I'm saying it correctly.
Alka Sharma.
Alka, yes. Sharma. Great. Welcome to the Lisa Show. When we talk about habits, I think that there's lots of things that we will say are habits or behaviors that we will say are habits, but they're not, I mean, necessarily clearly defined. How do you define what is a habit?
Well, a habit is something that is over time. It comes over time and it's habitual. So when we're talking about exercise, as I'm very passionate about health and fitness, so when it comes to exercise, how many hours, how many times a week are you putting into getting a good, great workout? Mm-hmm. So everything is a habit. So a habit is very broad in a sense, but I like to define habit as the habitual process that one needs to adapt to make a life feel and look great.
So when I hear timeline for habits, though, I often think that, you know, it's a thing that you do for 21 days. And if you can do it every day or, you know, muscle up, grit through 21 days, it then has likely become a habit. Is that sort of a rule that you follow?
Absolutely. So it's a rule of thumb. It's actually, yeah. So about 21, 30 days is maximum, because it takes about a month before, you can start to see great results. So whether it comes into your health and fitness goals, whether it's, you know, mindset. So about 30 days, it is a rule of thumb that you need to keep doing until it becomes ingrained in you.
So as we look maybe over the last year, we've probably established, if we've done the same thing over and over for more than 21 days, some not necessarily very healthy habits, whether that's sitting and binge watching something or maybe not getting the exercise or certainly the amount of screen time. So now it seems like we are having to turn and refocus and be able to establish some actual healthy habits.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, now, you know, during the pandemic last year, it was a time that no one knew we were going to be in this pandemic. But even now, and having said, it is the climate that we're in, and we just have to adapt to it. So what I would suggest, what I would recommend, is that don't spend too much time binge watching. Mm-hmm. And as I'm very passionate about movement is the key. So whether you're You have a 9-to-5 job. You're sitting behind a desk. Take that time to implement some stretching, because stretching is going to, you know, just get up off your desk and stretch, because stretching is going to allow you flexibility. It's going to allow you as women to really, you know, be so impactful with your kids. You're going to able to enjoy with your kids, you're going to able to do more chores around the house.
Mm-hmm.
So getting that movement is going to be the key, rather than just keep sitting and watching. So get up now and then to implement stretching.
Mm-hmm.
Get up and go for a walk. That's just amazing. You know, you're getting fresh air. You're getting a clarity, allows you clarity and focus. So when you do come back, you know, you're going to feel absolutely fantastic.
You know, working these things into a schedule, I think, is sort of the secret. And I don't mean like at 8:05 I this, but with wearable technology, like I'm thinking of Apple Watches and the mm-hmm. Android equivalent, where they give us sort of nudges to be like, hey, you've been sedentary for a little bit. That can certainly nudge us to be able to get up and to move around or to stretch. Are there other ways that you're able to work this in that don't feel as laborious as things like going to the gym or, you know, going to a yoga class, so that we can actually be able to incorporate these and make them habits?
Yeah, you know what? So absolutely, it's not like Fitbit.
Uh-huh.
Fitbit, you know, any kind of those trackers, you know, they're absolutely excellent, because, you know, you can wear them and it will show you, okay, how many steps you've taken, how many, you know, how many miles have you gone for your walk?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really good, because a Fitbit and any of those trackers actually really keep you engaged and really keep you on track of your goals. So whether your health and fitness goals is to lose weight, whether your goal is to get overall, you know, great health, mm-hmm. then you need to have one of these trackers that will keep you on track. And also, you know what I find mm-hmm. that very, very not so laborious, is body weight exercise. Now, body weight is one of my favorites, because, you know, leveraging your body is the most amazing, is the most fantastic thing. It's a primal movement
mm-hmm.
that, you know, no one really understands until, you know, you do it and you implement that into your daily life. So, like you said, you know, it is having a schedule
mm-hmm.
because health and fitness and nutrition, you need to have a schedule to keep you on track of your goal.
So when you talk about those body weight exercises, the other thing that I think is really great about them is that it eliminates excuses, right? Because you don't have to have the weights or the machine or the, you know, the mm-hmm. various things that we would sometimes say, oh, well, that's over there. I'd need to plug that in and clear the laundry off the treadmill and all that stuff. It is just the use of our body.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the number one is TRX, which stands for Total Resistance Exercise. And TRX is such a great revolutionary fitness trend now that, you know, if you don't have the sling, that is okay. But you can use body weight in other ways. For example, you could do squat lunges. You could do so any kind of those plyometric movement. The plyo simply means fast twitching your muscle fibers in short bursts of time. So when you have those incorporated, those movements, those really impactful, powerful movements, like box jump, mm-hmm. like squat lunges, that you're going to find you're going to burn calories. And also targeting those larger muscle groups is really going to be so amazing. And you're going to find, just like we said, so incorporating that into your schedule, but also doing, say, that 20 minutes a day is all you need.
We're talking with Alka Sharma about maintaining or starting healthy habits. And I think that there are two types of people likely listening to this conversation. One, that during the time of the pandemic, they have really sort of locked into some sort of physical activity, either a new hobby or sort of renewed something that they enjoyed previously. And because the time of the pandemic changed their schedule. They've been able to re-find that time and have been able to do it. And then the other side are those people who had a schedule based on, you know, their work or their going to work schedule, being able to go to the gym or had worked into the day, their routine of working out. And now that things are shifting, likely those things that would impact how their schedule runs day to day are shifting again. How can they be able to keep a focus on these healthy habits as life is returning to it was as it was before?
So with everything, so whether life is returning to normal, whether we're still in this lockdown, it is having a schedule, is having the management of time. So whether you're and you have a 9-to-5 job, whether you're stay-at-home mom, you're looking after your kids, you need to have the time for yourself. So self-care, self-time, managing your time, incorporating. Like, so for me, for example, I am an entrepreneur. I have a business. I have a fitness studio here in Canada. But I take the time out of my day to incorporate stretching, to go for a walk. Going for a walk allows me clarity and focus so that when I come back, I am so pumped and super focused on my work. So it's just scheduling your time, scheduling that time for you so that you can be fantastic. You can feel and look great each and every time so that you are focused and will give you so much clarity on your work. Yeah. So it's just having the time schedule, managing your time.
Yeah, I've heard in several circles that idea of the self-care, the taking time for oneself. I think it was Stephen Covey in his Seven Habits for Highly Successful People would talk about sharpening the saw and taking the opportunity to keep yourself sharp and keep yourself in a mental and physical place that you could be able to actually do the things that are asked of you. But so often we think, oh, we don't have time to do that. We'll just continue to cut with a dull saw.
Yeah, well, cutting with a dull saw is not going to get you to where you want to go. It's not going to get you to your end goal. So whatever your outcome is, so if your outcome is to lose weight and you have that X amount that you want to lose, 10 pounds, 15 pounds, 20 pounds, then with the dull saw, it's not really going to get you to where you want to go. So it is actually... Yes, self-love and self-care. So those are the most important that women really need to adapt. And sometimes we really get, you know, it's very neglected. It's at the back burner. And women, as, you know, entrepreneurs, mothers, we tend to neglect that because we want to focus and spend all that time devote to the kids, to the family. But I feel that it needs to be a balance. Life is all about balance. And if you can incorporate balancing your life, and what do I mean by balance? Because a lot of people say to me, Alpha, what do you mean by balance? And, you know, how can I achieve balance into my life? Well, you need to, as I said, you know, you need to manage, how do you manage your days? How do you manage your time? Because how you manage your day in one area, whether it's business, you will absolutely manage your time into other areas, other aspects of your life. So it is taking control of what you need to put yourself in the forefront.
Do you do this by way of like I don't want to say strict, but like you would schedule an hour at a specific time in the day for, you know, that workout or that self-care? Or is your approach more of like a to-do list? Well, today I've got to... this with the kids, this with my job, this with my physical or mental health?
It is actually a bit of both. You've got to have a to-do list, because if you don't have a to-do list, then you don't see that physically in front of you each and every day, then you're not going to get it done. And quite so often when we, whether it's affirmations, whether we set goals, if we don't write it down, when we're clearly not going to get it done. So it's all about, you know, making that list, making a schedule of what is going to come. What are you going to do today? What is your workout routine? What does that look like? Are you working on your upper body, your chest, your back, your biceps?
Mm-hmm. What are you working on? And then when you have a clear, defined schedule of your routine, your workout routine, and your nutrition, then it's clearly you're going to get the results, the outcome that you truly want. So it is making a to-do list, and then also then you're going to execute on what you said you want to get done.
Early in the pandemic, the joke was that, the COVID-19, that the 19 stood for the amount of weight in pounds that we would gain over the time that we were sort of quarantined. And I think for a lot of people, letting their physical routine slip was a thing that was very natural to do. I think that that's sort of a natural tendency, but likely folks are listening to this and saying, you know what, I know that I need to do something, but just need that coaching, that help, that inspiration, that little nudge to get to the first step to sort of catch on fire, as you have described it. So what is that first step? If someone knows that a change is necessary, but now just needs the oomph to get there.
So during the pandemic, I mean, all the gyms were closed last year, and so doing the workouts at home. So if you didn't have the machine, the bike, the elliptical, the treadmill, that is okay. Leveraging your body weight. So you could do circuit training. You could do jump ropes. You could do jumping jacks. Anything that was going to get your heart rate elevated, that is actually the first step. That's the basic that if you want to incorporate to get back into physical fitness is to start with these basics. So jump rope, if you don't have a skipping rope in front of you, then, you could just incorporate jumping jacks. Jumping jacks with a squat, squats doing walking lunges is the great way to do. So walking lunges with weights, you're working on your upper and lower body. So I would say this will be the basic that you need to, if you're looking to get back into physical fitness, and the gyms are still closed, we're still closed here in Canada for another lockdown, shutdown. Mm-hmm. So working out from home is going to be the most amazing. And once you start it, starting from today, you're going to see for the next 30 days, as we said, have a schedule. You stick to for the next 30 days, you are going to feel amazing. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about, looking and feeling great.
Your website, alkastotalfitness.com, does it help people if this is a new habit, something that they're completely learning, does it help them walk sort of baby steps or onboard into this process?
Yeah, absolutely. We have people starting from any facets of life. You don't have to be you don't have to be like an intermediate mm-hmm. to do any of our classes. You can start from... And what I do tell my clients is don't copy the person next to you mm-hmm. because they've been coming for a long period of time that they're already established into doing a TRX workout. So, start with at your own pace because your body, you need to listen to your own body and you can't copy someone next to you. So don't feel embarrassed that you can't do something. Because over time, you're gonna do amazing. Mm-hmm. But it's starting initially and listening to your body and going with your body and how it wants you to move.
Yeah.
And if you're moving at a slower pace, that is okay.
Yeah, the start of your journey is the start of your journey and not to compare it to someone else. We've been visiting with Alka Sharma, the president of Alka's Total Fitness, and also she is an exercise guru. You can learn more about her work and her online exercise classes by visiting her website, which is alkastotalfitness.com. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about how the pandemic has affected the way that we dream about the future. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
So, Richie, I have noticed a phenomenon that some people are starting to talk about in maybe veiled terms. Like they don't really want to come out and say it, but I think I've identified something that people want to talk about.
Is it like how you're leading into this segment by not actually
yes.
talking? Okay, okay.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
all right,
Do you
I'm ready.
See what I did there?
Yes.
I'm teasing you in the way that we have these sort of kind of covered conversations where people sort of dance around and they say things like, so how are you feeling about everything? What are you going to do this summer? What are you, what's happening this weekend? And it's, kind of a curious question, but one that people, I think, are using as a test to say, is it safe? Is it safe for me to start making plans?
Hmm.
So I've been reading these different articles that have been popping up about how our ability to daydream has been affected by the events of the last year.
Hmm.
And I've been thinking about it for a couple of weeks of like, is this true? And because I have been through some trauma and grief for the last year, I wanted to ask myself that too. Has it inhibited my ability to dream and even daydream about the future? And I think it has affected us. So I'll ask people like, well, what are you going to do in this summer? And maybe in years past, people would say, oh, I'm so excited. We're having a family reunion and we're going to do this thing and that thing. And or they'll say, oh, I'm really, really excited for this trip, or this summer I'm going to learn how to, and then ...
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we had those conversations. And now it seems, and again, this is just in my little world, that people say things like, well, I don't know. It depends.
Mm.
Well, I kind of want to do this.
Well, we thought about, yep.
We usually do this, but we probably won't get to. And so the conversations seem to be hesitant.
Mm.
They seem to be vague and conditional
yeah.
on a lot of different things. And so the conversation sort of stops like, yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, that's usually the conclusion. It does. And so my question to you and one that I think is happening that we can be a little bit more curious about and kind of maybe turn around a little bit and start doing is, how do you daydream when you think, oh, you know what I'd love to do
mm-hmm.
is, you know, go on a vacation or start this new thing? And I think that we all have, and rightfully so, just an exhaustion of trying to dance around what the future might be, not being in control, not knowing, not wanting to get excited and get our hopes, you know, kind of dashed.
Yeah, sure.
And so it affects it. And I am saying I want to bring daydreaming back.
So you're pro daydreaming. Is
yeah.
that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. And I want to have these kinds of conversations because, again, the idea of daydreaming is nobody's going to hold you to it. It's not like a goal or an ambition. It's just dreaming about, like, I can't wait to you know, host dinner parties and invite different people over, friends that I want to meet, right? And I want them to meet each other. And I want to start daydreaming about these kind of dinner parties.
So how much then do you think of this as just self-preservation? Because that's all I hear. I hear an expression of people who for a year thought, you know what I'm going to do this Christmas 2020?
Yeah.
And had that daydream, and they were willing to let themselves dream because it was so different from where they were of June 2020. And then they arrived to Christmas 2020, where in some places it was just as locked down as it was previously, some places even more. It is not dangerous.
I know. But
there is a hesitancy around setting yourself up for disappointment. And I think the natural tendency is, hey, if I could not be really disappointed,
no,
you know, to the point of like leaning into a depression or, you know, some sort of blues, if I can avoid that, I am going to avoid that as much as I possibly can.
Okay, so I hear what you're saying.
Right.
In that, I know why we've stopped and
right.
why we're slowing down. Maybe we need to, then the compromise is to start just daydreaming about small things,
mm-hmm.
things that we can start, you know, looking forward to in a new way and looking for new things, so that we don't get stuck in a moment or in a mind frame that inhibits us from ever daydreaming again.
Well, I mean, I think it's where joy actually comes from, quite honestly, right? The joy in being able to dream and then being able to fulfill some level of those dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's right because we sort of said, dream, what are you, crazy?
Well, everybody, hold on.
Yeah.
Hold on. Have you thought about, and yeah, we've overthought about everything. So now isn't it time to, maybe we've overcorrected. Is my point.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think
maybe we as a people do something in extremes? That's interesting. I'm not sure that we've ever done that before.
So I want to really ask you, though, honestly, what are you starting to just even daydream about?
Well, it is interesting. I found myself just a couple days ago, I guess, thinking about going to the grocery store without a mask. And here's the thing.
Really?
Yeah. I know. It sounds so weird.
Well, it just sounds small, but at the same time, it's not, I guess.
Well, so when I say daydreaming, I'm not like all my joys and glories will be fulfilled if I'm able to go to the grocery store not wearing a mask. That's not what I mean by daydreaming. But I define daydreaming as sort of when your mind is just sort of often thought, where does adventure
That's
to?
That's what I mean.
That's how I interpret daydreaming. And I thought, you know, there are several people, because I go to the two local grocery stores that are very near my house at the very same time every week, that habitually I see the same people who also do the same thing. And I don't know that I know what those people look like in real life. Like I don't know if, you know, this one gentleman has a beard or a goatee or a mustache.
Never know. Yeah.
And so the thing I found myself sort of daydreaming about was like being able to see and perfectly understand the person when they're talking to me, and I don't have to lean my better ear toward them and say, I'm sorry, can you say that again, please, so that I can hear you. And just sort of the joy, the very simple joy that I have from being able to be like, hi, how are you? And having that person smile back at me.
Yeah.
I found myself just sort of daydreaming within that space. So you're talking about California or going overseas in a trip like that.
Well, I'm not like, necessarily.
I'm just going to go get some avocados and some celery smile at my neighbor. What is this glorious euphoria?
I think that's a good point, though. And I do want to start small and encourage that we don't, you know, we talk about how things will never go back to normal, how some things will always change, and that could be good or bad. But I think one of the things that I hope we're able to move forward with a little bit is to being able to just dream a little bit about the kind of like connections we can make with people, making it less awkward, or even leaning into the awkwardness because it's funny or whatever it is. But just being able to start thinking about those ideas instead of resolving, oh, it's just always going to be like this.
Mm-hmm. The dangerous thing that I think within the various conversations that we have here on the show, the conversations that you and I have off the air, as I hear you talk emphatically about the connections that we have with people, the real worry that I have, the thing that if, you know, you use the phrase that keeps me up at night.
Yeah.
Is the worry that I have for individuals who will stay in the place of being quarantined. Now, obviously not real, you know, in real life quarantined, but will choose to cut themselves off from connections with other people, to allow themselves the opportunity to dream, to experience, to travel. And I'm not saying necessarily like cross state lines or, you know, overseas. I'm talking to be able to experience new things, who will, because of anxiety or maybe a real mental health diagnosis, will not live or lead a life that allows them new experiences beyond this point. And I think that there are some, I think that there are some who have found themselves so comfortable or, you know, with lack of connection, although missing out on it, they won't see the value in pushing out of it, and just will sort of, with lack of a better term, sort of become recluse. Those are the folks that I worry the most about. Because we extroverts will be like, boy, this grocery store is sure awkward.
Yeah.
Hey, how are you? Now we're fine. Or relatively fine.
Yeah. Those who want to make that kind of like social connection. I wonder what it is that we as a community at large then could do to help encourage that kind of connection, and not in the way that each one of us dictates it for the other person, but it's more encouraging of that sense of community and allowing for the differences. You know, we've talked here on the show of, you know, everyone's going to have their level of comfort, and maybe masks will never go away. And certainly, like, if I were feeling sick and I needed to, you know, go to the grocery store and I just had a cold, or, you know, something that wasn't, you know, I would never go to the store if I had the flu or something like that. But if I had like a cough or something, maybe I would now wear a mask where I would never even consider it before if I had to run and grab something at the grocery store,
sure,
you know, to protect other people. So, you know, is there something like that that's an equivalent of those who are feeling that they need, you know, they don't want to take any sort of risk to be able to? I don't know.
Well, I'm going to give you a hot take here.
Oh,
are you ready for this?
No, I'm ready.
What we can do as a community for those people who might not feel comfortable,
mm-hmm,
be kind.
Yeah, right.
Now,
right?
Hot take.
I know. It's so true.
Difficult. And I mean
no
that.
Public shaming, private shaming, but just allowing everyone to...
And being aware, I think, is another part of that. And to that, I mean, like, being kind, but also, like, you know, you have neighbors.
Yeah.
Do you know your neighbors? And I don't mean, like, go to their door and be like, hey, we're here and we want to make sure that you have social interaction, because that may not be the place for them.
Yeah.
But wondering how you're doing and however you do that, right? If it's an app on your phone, if it's a note on their door, mm-hmm, if it's just a genuinely being kind to other people, I think is how we're going to solve not only this, but a myriad of problems which we face in society. Simple
point.
Kindness.
Mm-hmm. And reaching out, though, mm-hmm, it's not just about having good manners and being kind when you meet people, but it's also, like you are saying, know your neighbors and reach out to those within your immediate vicinity and check, mm-hmm, on each other. And that's the way that can spread.
Yeah. I think about that so often. Do I know the name of the people that live to my left? Do I know the name and, you know, the people that live to my right? And if not, why? We used to do it. We used to be so good. I remember as a kid, block parties and street things and, you know, community affairs where you'd go and do that thing. And I think we get isolated in our own thoughts and our social media, and we feel like that's connecting. And I think that there is a presence of social community and being kind that will suit us well as we make our way through this.
And that is a dream worth dreaming.
So think about what you can do for those neighbors around you, a way that you can connect. We always like to provide the encouragement and the information to help you to be able to do that, and the reason why you should do that. Now, coming up, friend of the show and master storyteller from BYU Radio's Appleseed, Sam Payne, will be here. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Hi, this is Lisa.
Hey, it's me, Richie T. To do it.
You know what's good for you.
A bunch of things that I can do for the weekend. Welcome to The Lisa Show. I am Richie T. What would you do? Think about this for a second. If you saw a bear in your neighborhood. Well, coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to tell you how you can help protect the wildlife that you might find in your own community. And I'm going to tell you about a place that you would likely love to move, but that you probably can't afford. That's coming up in your morning buzz.
April marks a new chapter in our story this year. As we welcome a new season, we're also prepared to welcome in new adventures, stories, and memories. Let's aim to start this month with a wonderful story to get us through it. And luckily for this, we have our friend and storyteller Sam Payne here with us to tell us a story just to sort of get us started on our way of storytelling. Welcome, Sam.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. You know, I on my show, The Appleseed, filled with all kinds of stories, tall tales, tales and fairy tales and folk tales and things like that. We there's a thing that we say on the show. And the thing that we say is we always hope that the stories that we bring you on the show spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people that you love. And we engage in that exercise even on the show. You know, we'll be sharing an episode filled with folk tales, for example, and I will share a personal story about something that comes to my mind as I hear these folk tales. And not too long ago, we were sharing a bunch of animal stories, and I had a memory, a thought, and I wrote it down. I will share it with you. When I was a kid, my family had some friends who ran a preschool. We loved visiting them, especially when we were tiny. The preschool was on the main floor of the family home, and the family lived in the basement. The basement looked just like a regular place someone might live, but upstairs was a wonderland. There were colorful bookshelves and rooms dedicated to crafts of one kind or another, places to paint and spill and make a mess and clean it up and keep going at that as long as you liked. And the backyard, too, was a pretty magical place to be. It was a playground that rivaled the playground at any elementary school, geodesic domes to climb on and enormous cement pipes buried in the ground to crawl through as tunnels, all kinds of stuff. And in the background, there was always music. There was an album we liked all about dinosaurs on their shelves. It's where I first learned the words Tyrannosaurus Rex meant tyrant king. And all the dinosaurs on the album had names. One song with which we loved to sing along recited their names. It went, Terry Pterodactyl, Bruce the Brontosaurus, Trini the Triceratops, Stanley Stegosaurus, Tom Tyrannosaurus, he is carnivorous. That was lots of fun. Now let's sing another chorus. And on and on and on and on and on we'd go. We loved that dinosaur album for sure. But our favorite music for visits to our friends was contained on an album called Spin, Spider, Spin. It was filled with songs written by Patti Zeitlin and Marsha Berman, a couple of musicians and teachers. The songs were all about insects and reptiles, spiders, snakes, bees, stuff like that. And each song had something to say that might help a young listener understand the animal that the song was about and also to be less afraid of that animal. There was a song about bees that said, if they fly by your eye, try to be steady and still. If they fly by your nose, just be ready until you can watch them go home. Watch them fly through the trees. They will leave you alone. That's the way of the bees. Right? And there was a beautiful, melancholy song sung by a creature that was never named in the song. The creature sang, winding down the dusty road, no one walks behind me. Winding down the dusty road, I hope no man may find me. No human have I tried to harm, though men hold me to blame. I'm searching for a place that's warm, as secret as my name. And I think about those lyrics now and I can see how much a product of their time they are. They're these really kind of 70s lyrics, right? But when I was 7 or 8, I thought I had stumbled onto some heavy poetry, man. And what's best, it was a mystery song. And we who were listening were left to figure out what the creature was. We always thought that since the animal was winding down the dusty road and that it needed to be someplace warm and that people blamed it for certain harms, that it must be a snake. I still think it's about a snake, though I guess I still don't know for sure. I mean, the song never does say. And there was even a song on the album about responding to the death of a little bird. All these songs designed for kids to leave all of the wonder in their interactions with nature, but to take away the fear. We loved those songs very much, and we loved to visit our friends in order to hear them. In those days, we lived in a place where we were likely to have random encounters with snakes or bees or spiders. Maybe that's every place. But because it was so easy to perceive those things with an eye of enmity, it did us a lot of good to have some sort of influence that helped us look at them with an eye of, if not brotherhood, then at least co creaturehood, right? Since then, I've had snakes as pets, if you can believe it. We're preparing to help our daughter right now set up as an apiarist, a beekeeper. I've met and loved animals that might once have frightened me. And that's not to say that I haven't delivered the death blow to my share of mosquitoes or houseflies. And it doesn't mean I haven't avoided the claw or stinger end of some of my animal brothers every now and then. I'll give a lot of space to a critter that looks like it needs it. But overcoming the fear isn't the same thing as embracing the fang. But I think I'm more inclined than I might otherwise have been to look with a friendly eye on my fellow animals. But even more than their effect on my interaction with the animal world, I think those early interactions with songs and stories, like the ones on the Spin Spider Spin album, helped me to see people with an eye of brotherhood. I think often of a conversation I had with the great storyteller and songwriter Bill Harley, who cited as one of the byproducts of his travels around the world on the performing stage, meeting all kinds of people, was that he saw them all as fellows. But that's paraphrase. What Bill actually said was, "I'm not afraid of anybody." And in a world filled with anybodies to feel one way or another about, that seems like a pretty good place to be. So some thoughts about,
wow, that's wonderful.
Those old records we used to listen to at our friend's house. You know?
Remember those old records. It's so great that you remember the tunes to them as well.
Well, to be honest, I have to say that I'm in this kind of weird period in my life because everything's available on eBay.
That's so true.
I'm finding myself following up on some of these memories by seeing if I can inexpensively obtain some of these things. And darned if I didn't find a copy of the album Spin Spider Spin for sale for a couple of bucks somewhere. And I picked it up, so I'd have that now.
Isn't that great, though, because it helps to connect those memories. I know when I first became a mother, I kind of remembered the childhood songs that my mother would sing to me.
Yeah.
But because it had been so many years since she had sung them to me, I was missing a couple of words or whatever. I remember asking her, and she typed them all out and laminated, like a great
so
new grandmother
great,
does.
You know, yeah.
And then I knew every word, and I had it all ready to go. And now I've sung them so many times. I'll never forget them.
Yeah.
And so I think it's okay to go back and try to fill
sure
in those memories.
And what an important thing you bring up, this notion of talking to some of the people who were part of those memories, right? I mean, mm-hmm. We sometimes make the mistake of thinking that the first person memories that we have are complete. You know, we say to ourselves, well, of course I remember everything about that. That there is to remember. I was there.
Right.
You know?
I was the first person account.
Yeah. We've had such a wonderful, there's a wonderful tradition that has grown up during a time of pandemic for me and my siblings. My sister lives in England. My brother lives in Tennessee. My other brother lives in L.A. And mm-hmm. and we decided that we would get together on Zoom every week and chat for a bit. And it's been so, so great. And even in this very last meeting, I was sharing a memory from my point of view of something that had happened when we were 8 years old. My little brother had accidentally lit the grass field on fire behind our house with some leftover 4th of July fireworks. And that was all kinds of fun. But he remembered 50 things about that I didn't, And I remembered a few things about it that he didn't too, But this notion of going to the other people who were there
mm-hmm.
and saying, what can you remember about that? Because this is what I remember about that.
I think it's such a gift to be able to share that.
It sure is. Yeah.
Being able to give someone a detail or a memory that they forgot and be able to bring it back to life.
Yep.
To me, that is such an under-talked about sort of gift. And you can do that with people you went to high school with or you grew up with or siblings, family members. It's interesting, too, when you get a bunch of family members together and you all remember the same event differently.
Yeah.
No, I said that.
Yeah.
No, you said that. I mean, that can get fun.
Yep. I lived for a long time far away. I mean, even in those days, we lived what to me was an ocean away from the family that had the preschool. You know, mm-hmm. in reality, we lived about 17 miles away. You know,
but, isn't that the funniest thing?
Yeah, yeah. And my travels have taken me to, you know, different mm-hmm. places. But I actually live now in the town where that preschool was, and I drive by it every third or fourth day. And wow. of course, it's not a preschool anymore; it's just somebody's house. But even driving by brings back a lot of memories.
It's great to have those memories to keep them alive. You always inspire us to do the same. Sam, I could listen to you tell stories all day long. So what should I do? Where can I go?
You should subscribe to the Appleseed podcast.
We're
on the air. You can hear us on BYU Radio for a couple of hours just about every day, 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. But you can also subscribe to the podcast. And there's a bunch of stuff there that's not on the show. Podcast extras that only exist in the podcast.
It's such a gift. If you haven't been over there, you should be subscribing because it's so great to have your podcast just on the go ready.
Yeah.
Like if I'm in my car with my kids and, you know, we want to do something together.
Yep.
It's great co-listening. It will be right there if you subscribe. And like you said, if you catch it on the radio, that's great, but you're going to get something extra on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, in fact, we'll bring you we'll try to bring you an hour, a couple of hours worth of storytelling just about every day on the show. But the podcast features podcast extras that are just a few minutes long. We know sometimes you just have a few minutes and you want to fill those few minutes with a great story. And so, you know, between your door and the store, you can grab a little story from a great storyteller.
Great. Thank you so much for being here, Sam.
Of course, thank you.
Now, coming up, we're going to find out how we can protect the vulnerable wildlife that are in our very own communities. And I'm going to give you a moving destination. You might like to move to this place, but I doubt you're going to be able to afford it. I'll tell you where that is coming up in your morning buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Are you looking to reconnect with nature this summer? Well, coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to tell you why Olympic National Park is the perfect place to do so. But first, we have got your morning buzz. It's three things that are trending online right now, things that people are talking about. Were we to ever have water cooler talk again in the future? These are the things that we would be talking about today. Last night on the ABC, that's one of the original networks, kids. See, back in the day, there only used to be four channels. Listen, just YouTube a history about it, and if you want to find about that, there's a TV show called Home Economics that premiered, and they're saying, hey, this may be ABC's new big family comedy. It's three different siblings that come from very different income brackets, and hilarity ensues as they relate to one another. It's called Home Economics, and it's actually being reviewed pretty well on the internet today. Also, new music, apparently. I talked in an earlier morning buzz about a new song from Taylor Swift. Well, the folks of 21 Pilots have a new song that's out today, and millions of views have been acquired by them as well. Shy Away is the name of their song. It's pretty good. It's very 21 Pilots-esque-ish. You can tell it's the 21 Pilots when you listen to it. It's called Shy Away. And then finally, a lot of people thinking about moving, right? You've been in your home. You're thinking, oh, man, I could use a home office. I'd like to move somewhere else. We've talked here on the show about the California exodus, people leaving California, going elsewhere. People leaving New York, going elsewhere. One of the places that a lot of people are apparently putting on their prime location moving spot, New Zealand. Why? Because it's been virtually COVID-free because of the restrictions that they've placed there. It's also beautiful. If you've ever seen a New Zealand picture, I'm sure you've never said, well, that's not very good looking. Every single picture from New Zealand, it seems, is postcard worthy. But here's the problem. If you think that, and this doesn't matter where you live here in the United States, that the cost of living where you live is expensive, just look at like a one-bedroom place in New Zealand. Likely, you won't be able to afford it, especially for those of us who are not New Zealanders. But people are saying, man, I would love to move here. I just can't afford it. It's New Zealand because it's COVID-free. They just won't let you buy a home there. And that is your morning buzz.
From James Bond to Mission Impossible, spy movies are always highly entertaining. You know, there's those fun gadgets, crazy codes, high-speed chases. What's not like to like, you know? But while they make for great movie plots, it makes us think if these storylines accurately depict a spy's life in the real world and outside of what we see in the movies, what does a spy's life actually look like and what does their job entail? Well, here to give us some top secret answers to everything from classified cases to actual spy agencies is author of National Geographic Kids' newest book, Top Secret, Crispin Boyer. Welcome, Crispin. Thanks for being here.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
Crispin, if that is your real name.
We're getting right into it.
Believe it or not, it is.
Well, so tell us a little bit about the book and what kind of secrets are uncovered in Top Secret.
Sure. Well, yeah, you did a really good summary of it. It's a lot of it is for aspiring young spies. You know, spies are a very fascinating topic. Spy craft, trade craft, secret gadgets. So, yeah, the book goes into the job of the spy, the history of the job, which is really a very old profession going back all the way to ancient Egypt. In terms of it being like what they see in the movies, you know, James Bond or that TV show Alias, and that's the one. It might be a little disappointing, but it's not. Spy's life isn't all about fast cars and martial arts fights and running from explosions. And in fact, if any of those things really happen, it means the spy has failed miserably at his or her job and is probably going to be fired or captured.
too flashy. The spy, what is it that they get wrong? Do you think?
Yes. Yeah, it's too flashy. A spy tries to be as boring and as invisible as possible, to blend in. You know, so spies will create a backstory called a legend for where they're from, their job, and sometimes creating a whole career for wherever they're infiltrated. Like, there could be a foreign government. It could be another corporation, corporate espionage. So a spy basically lives a double life. They have this cover story that they have to stick to. And, you know, in researching the book, we actually interviewed a real CIA agent who's was very forthcoming. And, you know, spies do know some fighting moves, but basically it's to help them escape from tricky. It's more about evasion. It's like kicking your captor in the shin to get out of there. It's not so much about jamming their nose into their brain or whatever James Bond does. But yeah, and you know, there are actual spy gadgets, which is, like, young readers find that maybe the most fascinating thing. A lot of the gadgets though are based more around camera technology. Hmm. Nowadays, a small camera, a tiny camera is no big deal. You have camera in your phone. You have GoPro cameras that back in the Cold War and World War II, that would have been like the greatest lifesaver for a spy, to have this little digital camera they could use to record hours of video. But back then they had tiny mechanical cameras that relied on tiny rolls of film that they then had to transport back to their handlers. So it was these little amazing cameras that are mechanical and they rely on chemical processes. So, yeah, we cover a lot of those types of cameras, including some that we even put on birds, the homing pigeons, to fly over and take pictures of enemy lines and things like that.
Oh, wow.
Talking with Crispin Boyer, who is the author of the newest book from National Geographic Kids called Top Secret. It's all about spies. I'm going to go out on a limb, Crispin, and I am going to assume that you were that kid that was obsessed with spies, spy gear, spy cameras, and now this is your opportunity to be an adult kid as you've written Top Secret.
Yeah, you've blown my cover. That's exactly right. No, I was always fascinated, especially by codes, secret codes. And there's a lot of we have a lot on secret codes in the book, so that readers can know how to use secret codes to transmit messages to their friends. And these are codes that have been around a long time. A lot of them just involve swapping letters in the alphabet and then having a cipher to decode it once they get to your friend. So, I've always been really interested in it. And, of course, whenever they had code busting in World War II and in modern times, And then is it these, like, it's almost secondary, this intelligence war going back and forth, not just real conflict, the war, like the physical war, but then the secondary, very high, not so much high tech, but high concepts of trying to crack codes and create machines that can crack codes.
Hmm.
And so, you know, parents who buy this book for their kids or aunts and uncles or whatever, they might suddenly see the kids passing around hidden messages, coded messages, and then they might need to borrow the book to decode the messages.
Oh, I like it. They can use it to create the problem and to solve it. What are some things that you learned? I know, right? What are some things that you learned about spy agencies, though, that most people probably don't know?
Well, that they're into some crazy stuff. Like, some of the stuff that you would think is only fit for a movie, actually, spy agencies were really involved in that. So there was this mission, this program called Stargate, that the CIA was involved with going back to the 70s, where it really started because the Russians, the Soviets at the time, back in the Soviet Union, were experimenting with ESP and remote viewing using psychics to project their minds behind, you know, into our facilities and draw out pictures of, you know, whatever's going on at NASA or DARPA or any of these secret intelligence communities. So the CIA started its own program, started recruiting people who claimed they had remote viewing capabilities, and it was never meant to take over the physical spy on the ground, but it was just another way to try and glean some intelligence. So it was a real thing, and it actually lasted until the late 90s. So they actually put money and stock and effort into trying to harness these psychic spies, and they never really, at least they didn't admit to having any real success from it. But that kind of thing I really think is interesting, when these things that sound like sci-fi or comic books actually happen in real life.
Yeah, people want to know about stuff like that.
I also am curious how you talked about sort of the legends, right? The backstory that is untrue, but we don't actually know that about these spies if we ever find out that they're spies. How many of these spies are actually, like we see in the movies, you know, married, and the spouse is like, oh, I don't know what he does. He just, or she does. She just goes to the office, and then they find out that they're spies. Is that real, or do people sort of know that their spouse is up to that?
Well, whenever I interviewed the CIA agent, she told me that she, you know, her husband knew that she worked for the CIA, but that was really about it.
Hmm.
And she was sent overseas, and, you know, she basically just tells her family that she's going on a business trip. So it can last a few months. So, yeah, there's definitely there are limits to what they can tell. I think you got to figure most secretly do let their partners know what they're up to. You know, if they don't,
it makes
back,
you wonder.
Nice. Yeah.
Well,
no, that's a part of the lifestyle.
Mm.
Well, Crispin, this message is going to self-destruct in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Crispin Boyer is a National Geographic kids writer who's written 10 books, including this newest release. It's called Top Secret. If you want to get more information from Nat Geo Kids, you can go online to natgeokids.com. Crispin, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Now, we love being able to share books that you can share with your kids, things that will inspire those young learners, being able to, you know, explore space or, you know, what it might be to be a spy or some other profession. And we also really like to be able to focus on things that can bring the outdoor, the outside world in, that can show sort of our social responsibility within the world which we live in.
What do you know about the wildlife in your local area?
There's birds. And
do you know what kind? I see deer in
blue,
my neighborhood all the time. Oh, bluebirds.
Swallow, magpie, a robin,
a dove. Right.
Sometimes Robert, my adopted poodle, and I will chase a coven of quail around the neighborhood.
Yeah. You just wanted to throw in that you knew the word coven of quail, didn't you?
I mean.
Well, we are talking about this because it is National Wildlife Week, and we wanted to talk about the various types of wildlife that are all around us. And so we've invited David Mizowski, a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation, to share with us how we can better learn about and connect with the nature and animals wherever we live. Welcome, David.
Hello there.
So what, National Wildlife Week, what is it? How do we celebrate it?
Sure. National Wildlife Week is something that we've been doing at the National Wildlife Federation for decades. And it's really a week where we just try to really focus on what we do year round, and that is celebrate wildlife and hopefully inspire people to want to get involved in the efforts to conserve and protect and restore wildlife. And so this year, our theme for National Wildlife Week is America's Unique Wildlife. You know, I was thinking about what we wanted the theme to be, and it just dawned on me that when we think about wildlife, we oftentimes think about, you know, animals from all around the world, you know, lions and giraffe and pandas and everything. But we've got such cool wildlife right here in America, and a lot of them are interesting and unique, and a lot of people don't even know about them. So that's kind of our theme. And, you know, we can give a bunch of information about some of those species and ways to get involved on the National Wildlife Week website, which people can Google, and it'll be the first thing that comes up.
Well, I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about that unknown element of the wildlife that surrounds us in the United States. What's something that you could tell us that maybe we aren't aware of about the wildlife?
So, you know, every region has an animal that probably is not very well known. And so, you know, for example, there is an animal that is roaming the desert southwest that looks like a pig. It's got a pig snout.
Okay.
It actually kind of behaves very similar to pigs. It lives in herds and, you know, has you know, babies and, you know, that kind of thing. But it's not a pig at all. It's actually an animal called a javelina. And javelina are kind of peccary. And the reason that they're not pigs, even though they look almost exactly like pigs, is that if you look a little bit below the surface, they've got different teeth, they've got different feet, they've got different ears, they've got a different tail, they've even got a different internal digestive tract. And so they're really actually not closely related to pigs at all, even though they look very similar. And, you know, as I travel the country, I find that unless you are from Arizona or New Mexico or parts of West Texas, you have no clue that these animals are running around, even though they're fairly common. And in like in other parts of the country where you might get deer showing up in your backyard, mm-hmm. Well, javelina kind of fit that same role down in the desert southwest. And they're just really, you know, interesting animals that I think deserve a little bit of attention.
Wow.
The javelina, you know, it's interesting. Huh. So you have completely blown apart the old adage that if it walks like a pig and looks like a pig, it's not, in fact, a pig. Blow our mind again. What else in this country might we not know about?
So there's one of my favorite species is a really cool salamander that is called a hellbender. And it's really cool because that name is really cool, right?
Yeah, right.
They are these giant salamanders. They can get to be 10, maybe 12 inches long, that live in sort of the eastern half of the country, sort of in the, if you follow kind of like the Appalachian Mountains north to south and into the Ozarks, sort of that sort of center part of the eastern half of the U.S., they live in fast-moving, cold streams with rocky bottoms, and they're just bizarre looking. Again, if you go to the National Wildlife Week website, you'll see a picture about them of one of them. They are camouflaged to look like the bottom of the stream beds. They're all like rocky and stony. They have beady little eyes. They have these huge heads, and they have these very strange skin flaps. They look like their skin is too big for their body. But that's, of course, an adaptation. The skin color helps them be camouflaged on the stream bottom. Their flat bodies help them sit underneath the rocks so they don't get swept away by the current. And those skin flaps give them more surface area because amphibians can absorb gases and liquids right from their surroundings, right? So those skin flaps help the hellbender salamander absorb oxygen from the water without having to go to the surface. So really, really neat animals. And the other cool thing about them is that their nickname is Snot Otter because, like many amphibians, they're coated in mucus, and that helps protect their skin. And, yeah, so hellbender or snot otter, either way you cut it, it's a pretty cool animal.
You know, Snot Otter and Hellbender is actually what we thought about naming this show, but we decided to just keep it with the Lisa Show. But that was interesting. That was the runner-up to the Lisa Show.
Now, David,
you might get some new listeners if you do that.
Yeah, really? And yeah, a different demographic, actually.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, David Mizajewski, you're a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation, and it's really interesting talking about these animals that have, you know, kind of lived among us, if you will, the javelina and hellbender, or, you know, known to those who love them as the snot otter, you know, to bring our attention to these lesser known or appreciated, you know, players in the wildlife. But I'd love to talk to you about what else you do really at the Federation in knowing that every region needs to protect these creatures. Where can people go to get more involved and really recognize those creatures close to us and how we can protect them?
Well, hopefully folks will go check out the National Wildlife Week website. It's nationalwildlifeweek.nwf.org. You can just Google it. It'll be the first website that comes up. But we've got a whole bunch of information on there on how you can get involved. And what better week to do it than National Wildlife Week? So you can let your voice be heard. In fact, we've got a pledge that you can take. If you take the pledge, we're going to enter you into a contest to win a wildlife gear and go pack. Lots of great stuff that will help you experience the outdoors. But, you know, we've got opportunities where, you know, if you're more of an activist type, you can let your elected officials know that wildlife should be a priority. You can follow us on social media and signal boost us that way and get these pro-conservation messages out there. You can take, you know, sort of personal actions. We've got information on how to plant the right trees to support wildlife. We've got a link to our native plant finder where you can put in your zip code and we'll give you a list of the best plants to support butterflies native to your zip code. So lots of different ways to get involved there. And we even have, you know, for those of you who are more a little consumer oriented, we have shopping opportunities that every purchase that you make from our shop site, whether it's for a t-shirt or a sweatshirt with wildlife on it or a birdhouse or a bat box or anything in between, all of those sales go directly to support the National Wildlife Federation's Wildlife Conservation Program. So no matter what your vibe is, you can join the effort at nationalwildlifeweek.nwf.org and do something positive for wildlife.
So many times people will get discouraged because they're just one person. What's the impact that one individual who listens to this and is inspired to take action, what can they impact?
Well, you know, first I would say that your voice is powerful, even as an individual. So that's where, again, if you contact your elected officials and let them know that wildlife is a priority, that has a huge impact. But you know what? Even on those personal actions, yeah, they might not make a big difference on an individual level, but when I do them and you do them and all the listeners do them, the benefit is exponential, and it really does have an impact on wildlife.
On a national scale, you know, talking to people who can have an impact on making, you know, policy, you know, is one thing. What about other protections that are in the works for wildlife? What does that look like on a national level?
Well, there's this really awesome piece of legislation, if I do say so, called Recovering America's Wildlife Act that we've been championing at the National Wildlife Federation. This is a bipartisan piece of legislation. So, you know, let's put politics aside. We all can agree that we love wildlife and we want to protect it. That uses existing funding sources to fund the conservation work on the state level where the state wildlife agencies know how to protect wildlife. We've got great track record with a lot of species. They just need more resources. And so the Recovering America's Wildlife Act will give them those resources. There's 12,000 species right here in the U.S. that are declining and that are in need of conservation help, but we don't have the resources to do it. So that's a really, you know, could be a really critical piece of legislation if it gets enacted into law. And so there is a link on the National Wildlife Week website if folks want to learn more about that. And again, add your voice to ours in saying, hey, this is a really great win-win for wildlife and for people. And it's a really great thing to do.
Whether they want more information about National Wildlife Week, they want to get activated, or they just want great information, give the website one more time.
It's nationalwildlifeweek.nwf, as in National Wildlife Federation, .org.
And we've been visiting with David Mizajewski, who is a naturalist. He is with the National Wildlife Federation. Happy National Wildlife Week to you, sir. We continue our conversation about the outdoors with an upcoming edition of Lisa's Adventure Club. We're going to Olympic National Park. You're listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Now, on Thursdays here on The Lisa Show, from now into perpetuity, for the remainder of the spring and into the summer and likely into the fall, you will hear Lisa's Adventure Club. It's an opportunity for us to travel via technology to places across the country, national parks and the areas surrounding national parks, to give you inspiration, places that you may have on your bucket list or maybe give you an idea to add to that bucket list of places that you want to see, that you'd like to travel to, especially as travel is opening up. When you're visiting a new place, ask yourself the question, what is it that you're most excited to see? Is it the architecture, the natural architecture of that particular place? Maybe you like the people. Maybe you are like one of those, we call them foodies, that you think, man, I can't wait to get to the area surrounding that national park to eat all of the delicious things that are, you know, accustomed to that area. Well, for Lisa's Adventure Club this week, we're visiting Olympic National Park in Washington State. And we wanted to focus on the rich biodiversity of the park. To the untrained eye, wildlife might not be the first thing that you notice. But seeing as each national park has so much to offer in that department, we solicited the help of Carolyn Wilcox, a hiking and birding guide and the owner of Experience Olympic, on the show to share more about the natural beauties of Olympic National Park. Welcome, Carolyn.
Hi, thanks.
Thank you for being here. Now, give me an idea of your interaction with Olympic National Park. Are you from there or have you transplanted yourself there?
No, I'm originally from Ohio, so this is a even more special place for me.
So give me an idea what an Ohio gal does that gets her to travel across the country, essentially, and end up doing these kind of things around Olympic National Park.
Well, it actually started in the Sonoran Desert with an experience I had as an undergrad studying biology. And I had the amazing opportunity to spend 3 months there during the spring, so like basically at this time of year, which is really an amazing time to be in the desert. And that prompted me to want to be out west, and I went to graduate school at the University of Nevada, Reno, and then I ended up in Seattle, and then I ended up on the Olympic Peninsula.
And for people who may not know, like they said, Olympic Peninsula, hold on, what even is that? Give them an idea of where in relation to, say, like Seattle that we're even talking about.
Sure. So west of Seattle, and there actually is a west of Seattle besides the Pacific Ocean, the Olympic Peninsula is surrounded by water on three sides, and bridges and boats are commonly used to come and go. And then in the middle of the peninsula is Olympic National Park, which also includes a sliver of coastline. But the coast is just, you know, like not a very large portion of the park, but it does stretch from north to south. So you can do some amazing coastal hikes as well. And since time immemorial, six tribal nations live in around what is now Olympic National Park. And one of my favorite places to visit to get an idea of what life was like before the park was created is the Macaw Museum in Nia Bay, which is near the northwest corner of the continental United States.
Wow. So already I feel like I've learned so much. I wasn't aware that it was a peninsula, and I wasn't aware of the people for time immemorial who had lived around there. You are a hiker and a birder. I feel like I know what hiking is, but maybe you could explain a little bit more about what being a birding guide or a birder is.
Sure, yeah. So birding is a little bit more loosely framed and can sometimes be associated with twitchers, which is more a term that I've heard used in the UK. But oftentimes these people chase birds, go to birding festivals, might be users of eBird or other birding apps and technology to try to find out where birds are located. And then there's kind of more bird watchers, and I would definitely consider myself one of those as well. And they often have, let's say, like bird feeders, and are very aware of the birds that surround them, that they live near, but they're not necessarily, you know, spending all their vacation time looking for birds. They are probably also interested in lots of other wildlife as well.
It's interesting, the two sort of different classifications that you've given for that. I can remember as a young boy, we had a cabin in the northern part of California, and Grandma had a book from the National Audubon Society, and she kept it right next to her binoculars. And, you know, we would go outside and we would sort of notice, oh, what bird do we think that is? And we would try and find it and classify it. But these people that are the twitchers or sort of the birders to the nth degree, are they trying to chase or follow these birds so that they can know like what their migration patterns are? Is it like a birding bingo where they sort of mark, well, I've seen that one, I haven't seen that one, and they're trying to complete some sort of list? Or what's that sort of extreme birding?
Yeah, there's definitely different varieties even within the extreme birding. So like if you have like a marathon runner, right, like that can mean different things. Like, are they going to do a half marathon? Are they just doing it for fun? Mm-hmm. You know, so there's definitely like those differences among the birding people as well. I think what you described is definitely kind of how I grew up as well, being encouraged to, you know, have identification guides and, you know, get to know whether it be birds or mushrooms or whatever, you know, that you want to identify. And I would say, though, that oftentimes, like, these people are really, you know, are driven a little bit by competition, which is, you know, adds different element to it. And so, you know, whether they're, you know, interested in being considered in a county or in a state, there's often, like, some kind of, like, geographical interest as well that goes along with, like, their interest in birding. But they're also usually very aware of habitat and, you know, and so there's a lot of, like, ecological repercussions, I feel like, as well, that they're learning, even if they're not, like, fully aware of it.
So you are a hiking and birding guide. I'm hoping I can expand that out just a little bit and make it our travel guide for Olympic National Park. If someone is listening to this, no matter where they live in the country, give us an idea. I'm assuming, based on how we've sort of already framed this conversation, that if we were flying, we would fly into Seattle, and then it's driving distance?
Yeah, so you would either take the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, typically, which would, you know, and Tacoma's about a half an hour away from SeaTac. So SeaTac is Seattle-Tacoma Airport, and it's, like, kind of halfway between Seattle and Tacoma. You can take the Tacoma Narrow Bridge, and then it's, like, 2 hours to Port Angeles, which is where I live, which is kind of the headquarters of the park, but the park's really big, so that's not the only way to necessarily get there or experience it. And then if you're coming from Seattle, there are two ferries. There's the Seattle-Bainbridge Ferry and the Edmund-Kingston Ferry, which gets you kind of on the other side of a body of water that then, and then you kind of have to cross kind of even another body of water in order to get over to the Olympic Peninsula. And it's about, once you get across on the ferry, which can take about an hour, just kind of depending, then it's another 2 hour drive usually. So it's usually, I usually tell people to count on about a 3 hour journey.
So it seems like it's pretty isolated, right? At least away from the main thrust of the population. Can people stay actually in the park, or do we need to be looking for Airbnbs and lodges that are the outside?
Yeah, that's a great question. Airbnbs have definitely exploded on the scene. And, you know, we have a housing crisis, so that's been kind of interesting, trying to, like, balance those things out. But I would say that there's also definitely park lodges that are in the park. Some of those are run by, you know, they're run by, like, different companies that are, I guess, partners with the park. And so that's, like, a lot of national parks have that situation. And then, but there's definitely a lot of possibilities to be able to stay just outside the park in towns like Port Angeles and Forks, and then you can definitely explore the park from there.
We're visiting with Carolyn Wilcox about Olympic National Park. I was inspired by how you said at the beginning of this that it was in the Sonoran Desert in the springtime that made you sort of lead and guide your life as to where you have ended up at this point up up and around Olympic National Park. Is there a particular time of year, first of all, I guess, that would be more busy than others for Olympic National Park? And then secondarily, times that people, if they're going to go one time to experience this great national park, that they should go?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I really think the spring is the best time. You definitely have to weigh it with what your interests are. So Olympic is often known as three parks in one, which includes the coast and the forest, which also includes a temperate rainforest, and the mountains. And so, you know, the mountains are typically inundated with snow and much harder to access, although Hurricane Ridge is open usually during the winter season, and so you can go up there to like snowshoe and snowboard and ski and do kind of some of those activities. But I would say that definitely, you know, more people come during the summer, and so I just usually recommend the spring because there is kind of this sweet time period, kind of in May and June, really, where the weather vastly improves. The days get much longer. It definitely, there's still some rain, which really I think is important because it really kind of just clears the air and it just makes things fresher. And you get wildflowers growing at different elevations, and it's just a special time. Everything starts waking up too, like the Olympic marmots come out of hibernation. Black bears come out of their kind of more like partial hibernation, and so everything just kind of comes alive.
You've traveled all over, it seems, though I haven't asked you all of the specific places, but it seems like, you know, you have a fair share of being able to see a lot of the world. I would be curious, what is it that is special about Olympic National Park to you?
Well, to me specifically, I would say that having spent some really formative years in Costa Rica and getting to experience both the jungle and the beach, which sometimes were kind of continuous, and the cloud forest, I really kind of learned that the jungle, even though it's amazing and beautiful, like I often found myself dealing with you know, insects or things that really, like, love to bite my body. And so, you know, I also experienced that doing a field job in the Ozarks in Missouri, kind of on the border with Arkansas. And so I really appreciate about Olympic is that, you know, I am often not getting bit by insects. And so even though there is a time period where you can have mosquitoes up at the high lakes, It's not really something that you experience. Like in the forest, there's not, like in Ohio, you know, we always had poison ivy. Mm-hmm. We don't have that here. And so it's just a little bit more like if you're spending time off trail and so forth, you know, you're often not going to run into things that are going to bite you or, you know, make you itch for days or get you sick or those sorts of things.
You know, Arches National Park has Delicate Arch. I think that's sort of the monumental thing that people go there to see. Yellowstone has Old Faithful. What is the equivalent for Olympic National Park?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, I think for a lot of people, you know, getting to see a glacier, which are actually pretty prevalent in the park, but not easy to get to, can definitely become, you know, like a goal. And the Blue Glacier, you know, is definitely one that you can go and see, but it is like 18 miles in, so it's not something for the casual visitor. So I think just trying to really see the three parks, I think, is really like what kind of is the typical goal. So you can't really miss like the Ho Rainforest. I mean, really, the Quinault Rainforest is the same, and those rainforests are named after the people that live there, which are also the name of the large river valleys which drain those basins, and the rainforests are, you know, kind of pushed up against the mountains, so not like right along the coastline, because you kind of have to build up the clouds, and then that kind of like the clouds kind of squeeze out that extra water that gives you that rainforest classification.
Mm-hmm.
And then the beaches, like everyone has to visit one of the coastal beaches because they're all just amazing with the tide pools teeming with life and are the huge logs that come out of these old growth forests that come out of the rivers and then get pushed onto the beach is a really unique feature. And then the offshore islands and sea stacks. And then in the mountains, like amazing, unique plants and animals like the Olympic marmot. And I've found myself searching for, you know, rare plants like the Fletz violet that, you know, you only can find in the Olympic Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, yeah, going to those three different parks, you know, and having those special experiences are kind of what Olympics is all about.
We only have about 30 seconds left with you. People love national parks. How can we avoid loving them to death?
I think you should go with a guide. Guides really can help you to love a place without overloving it.
I love it. Carolyn Wilcox just happens to be a hiking and birding guide and the owner of Experience Olympic. It's there in Olympic National Park. You can learn more about the tours that she gives by visiting experienceolympic.com. Thanks for being with us, Carolyn.
Thank you so much.
Now, I would encourage everyone every Thursday, listen here to the Lisa Show for Lisa's Adventure Club, where we will highlight a national park, an opportunity for you to get out, whether it's with you and your partner, you by yourself exploring, or some great time with family and maybe other families as we start to open up the idea of that every Thursday here on the Lisa Show. It's Lisa's Adventure Club. And, you know, worth mentioning, The Lisa Show at BYU.edu if you have a national park that you would like us to be able to explore more through for you. That is The Lisa Show at BYU.edu. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. Find everything that you need on the new BYU Radio app. You can listen also on demand and find us on Sirius XM Channel 143. If you like something that you heard, you'd like to hear it again, please subscribe to our podcasts. Wherever you get podcasts, places like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Google Play. On tomorrow's show, we're going to tell you what you need to know before you start lifting weights. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show.